guys were the tip of the spear. They were out on the front so that American personnel didn't have to be.
Afghan nationals who teamed up with Americans during the war say the U.S. government is now abandoning them.
For Wednesday, December 10th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This hour, how the Trump administration is changing the mission of U.S. citizenship and immigration services.
Many immigrants now fear engaging with the agency.
I mean, number one is, am I going to get arrested? In almost every type of case, regardless of their past.
Also, both Democrats and Republicans are losing ground with young voters. We'll tell you why.
Young people are feeling like the state or the government is not, in fact, providing the opportunities that they're seeking.
And a widescreen movie format from the 1950s is making a comeback this year.
Those stories coming up after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump says the U.S. has seized a Venezuelan oil tanker. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports the Navy is pressuring Venezuela with a fleet assembled in the Caribbean.
President Trump says the tanker was very large, and he promises more news about Venezuela soon. This comes on top of the biggest U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean in decades and threats to Venezuela's leader. The U.S. has offered a $50 million bounty for information leading to the arrest of President Nicolas Maduro, who the U.S. claims is a narco-trafficker. Trump has said the U.S. may soon begin striking targets inside Venezuela's borders. Venezuela has the world's largest proven oil reserves, with about 1 million barrels produced daily. U.S. sanctions aim to strangle Venezuela's oil revenue, and the country is selling what it can at a steep discount, mostly to China. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
A new report finds public trust in the accuracy of monthly jobs numbers and other key statistics produced by the U.S. government is on the decline. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports the finding comes after President Trump fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics this summer after a weaker-than-expected jobs report.
The American Statistical Association's report finds a share of adults in the U.S. who tend to trust the federal government's economic indicators, health data, and other statistics declined between June and September, particularly among people with a graduate or professional degree, and people who identify as white and not Hispanic. Nancy Potok co-wrote the report and says staffing cuts at statistical agencies, funding shortfalls, and Trump administration statements questioning the credibility of federal data are hurting the government's ability to produce reliable information.
Congress, the executive branch, really have to prioritize investment in modernizing the system right away if the system is to survive and do its job.
Potok says many of the ongoing challenges facing statistical agencies have gotten worse this past year. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
Rwanda-backed M23 rebels say they have captured a strategic town in eastern Congo today. Conflict in the region is spreading despite President Trump declaring an end to fighting at a ceremony in Washington last week, Emmett Livingstone reports.
The streets of Uvira were mostly deserted early on Wednesday morning. Congolese troops had retreated, leaving an eerie calm punctured only by sporadic gunfire. After a week of heavy fighting, M23 rebels were on the outskirts of the town, strategically located on the border with Burundi. But by the afternoon, the rebel group announced that it had taken full control. It's a huge blow to the Congolese government and to President Trump, who hosted the presidents of Congo and Rwanda last week in a ceremony that was meant to mark the end of conflict in eastern Congo. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
The Pacific Northwest is bracing for another round of heavy rain, flooding, and evacuations after a powerful storm hit the region yesterday. The storm has already caused power outages, flooding, and school closures in parts of Oregon and Washington. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The daughter of Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado has accepted the Nobel Peace Prize on her mother's behalf. She said in a speech written by Machado that Venezuela shows the world we must be willing to fight for freedom. The chair of the Nobel Committee told the award ceremony that Machado had done everything in her power to attend, but that it was a journey in a situation of extreme danger. Australia's ban on social media for those younger than 16 went into effect today, as Christina Kukolha reports. The government says more than 200,000 TikTok accounts have been deactivated.
Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has hailed the ban as a reform that will change the lives of parents and children and reverberate around the world. Facebook, TikTok and X are among 10 platforms required to bar children under 16 from holding social media accounts. But 14-year-old Elliot Swan from Melbourne says he's not confident it will work.
Kids will always find a way around it. You know, people are talking about using different accounts, finding VPNs and stuff. I don't think it'll necessarily be the answer, and I don't think it's a brilliant idea.
Digital rights activists have launched a challenge to the ban in Australia's highest court, which is expected to be heard next year. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukolia in Melbourne.
A San Francisco woman gave birth inside a Waymo robo-taxi while on her way to the hospital. A spokesperson says the company's rider support team detected unusual activity inside the vehicle and alerted 911. It arrived safely at the hospital before emergency services. The U.S. stock market neared its all-time high today after the Federal Reserve cut its main interest rate. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez, now playing in movie theaters.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It's 4:06. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Timberlake Lodge, hosting a holiday dinner show Tuesday, December 16th, with performances by Greg Kaser, PK Mayo, the Miltich family, and members of the LaPlante family. More information at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Weather for tonight, mostly cloudy, lows near 3 below, and slight chance of snow tomorrow in the afternoon. Mostly cloudy, highs 10 to 15.
All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Federal Reserve voted to cut its benchmark interest rate today for the third time since September. And that will make it cheaper to borrow money to buy a car or grow a business or carry a balance on a credit card. The decision was not an easy one. Fed policymakers are unusually divided over which is the more urgent concern, a weakening job market or rising prices. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so I understand that today's decision by the Fed was more contested than usual. Why was that?
Well, I just think it speaks to the uncertain economic times we're in right now. You know, the job market does look as if it's softening, but inflation's still higher than most of us would like. So the Fed is kind of caught in this tug of war. Does it lower interest rates to try to prop up the job market or keep rates high to battle inflation? Fed Chairman Jerome Powell says it was not a slam dunk either way.
Everyone around the table agrees that inflation is too high and that we want it to come down, and agrees that the labor market has softened and that there's further risk. Everyone agrees on that. Where the difference is how do you weight those risks and what does your forecast look like?
In the end, a majority of the rate-setting committee voted for a quarter-point rate cut, which was the third in a row. But Fed officials also signaled they expect to be cautious about lowering rates anymore. On average, they expect just one more quarter-point rate cut in 2026.
Okay, so a majority favored the rate cut. But what about the other committee members?
Yeah, there were three dissenting votes, and they came from both sides. Two members of the committee wanted to hold rates steady today, and a third wanted to go with an even bigger half-point rate cut. Now, that's unusual for a group that usually tries to operate with a lot of consensus. In fact, it's the first time in 6 years that there was this much disagreement on a rate vote. But Powell says, look, that's okay.
These are good, thoughtful, respectful discussions. It's a close call. We have to make decisions. You can't do two things at once.
The committee was somewhat hampered by a lack of information. You know, because of the six-week government shutdown, we never got unemployment or inflation numbers for October.
Right.
And November's data is delayed until next week. So committee members had to rely on kind of stale numbers from September, along with whatever private sector and anecdotal information they could lean on. And the Fed was not exactly flying blind, but it did have some blinkers on.
Huh. Okay, well, the Fed has been under a lot of pressure from President Trump to cut rates more aggressively. Is that pressure campaign having any effect, do you think?
Not the kibitzing part of the campaign. You know, Trump has been very critical of Powell and his colleagues, but Powell says they make their decisions based on what they think's best for the economy, not political pressure. But Powell is nearing the end of his term as Fed chairman. He's going to oversee just three more rate-setting meetings between now and May. And after that, he will be replaced by a new Fed chairman of the president's choosing. Powell was asked today about what he wants his legacy to be, and the Fed chairman said he's really just focused on doing a job.
I really want to turn this job over to whoever replaces me with the economy in really good shape. That's what I want to do. I want inflation to be under control, coming back down to 2%, and I want the labor market to be strong.
Now, Powell has not said whether he plans to stay on the Fed board after his term as chairman ends. He could serve for another couple of years. That would be unusual, but it would deny the president the opportunity to install another loyalist on the Fed board and possibly help to preserve some of the central bank's independence.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
The Afghan man accused of shooting two National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C. is part of a community of former soldiers, allies of the United States, who have struggled in the U.S. since fleeing the Taliban. Rahmanullah Lakhanwal fought for years in so-called Zero units led by the CIA. Many Zero unit fighters now feel they're being abandoned by the CIA, and they're often facing despair and isolation. Some have taken their own lives. NPR's Brian Mann has our reporting, and we will note that the story does discuss suicide.
When a former Afghan soldier named Daoud, who lived in Kabul, first signed up for a CIA-led Zero unit, he says he was carefully vetted.
You needed somebody to recommend you in the unit, and after 2-3 months, background check and vetting process, you would get a call.
Daoud agreed to talk to NPR only if we identified him by his first name. He fears for the safety of his family still living under Taliban rule in Afghanistan. He says his service with the CIA led to years of fighting against some of the Taliban's toughest units. Groups like Human Rights Watch have accused Zero Unit soldiers of brutal tactics, including torture and illegal killings.
People think we were a death squad, we were an execution squad. No. We were out there, going out there, because we needed to bring these folks alive. If you bring a target alive, you get more information from him.
According to Daoud, those missions led him to believe he was part of a brotherhood with the U.S. military. He describes one firefight where an American CIA agent saved his life.
He said, grenade, and he grabbed me from my body armor, pulled me back. It was a crazy fight. Bullet went through my body armor, but, I was fine.
This was the kind of American-led Afghan unit that also employed Lakhanwal, who pleaded not guilty last week to murder and other charges in the National Guard shooting. Geeta Bakshi, a former CIA agent who served in Afghanistan, says Zero Unit fighters like Daoud and Lakhanwal were essential to America's war effort.
These guys were the tip of the spear. They were out on the front so that American personnel didn't have to be. They were the ones that were facing the maximum danger on the battlefield and taking the maximum risk due to their affiliation with U.S. intelligence.
After the Taliban swept to power in 2021, the Biden administration evacuated thousands of Zero Unit fighters, offering them a chance to start new lives in the U.S. But NPR has learned that many of these soldiers found themselves mired in America's complex immigration system. Despite vetting and background checks by the CIA, Daoud says he and many other soldiers struggled for years to gain permanent asylum and necessary work visas.
We asked the agency, could you please share our information so that when we submit our forms for our green cards, they know who we are. We are vetted. We have worked with you guys. They said, oh, no, we can't share this. It's classified. And I was like, then how would they know who we are?
NPR reported last week that Lakhanwal, too, struggled with his immigration status. He only received asylum protection from the Trump administration in April of this year, nearly 4 years after coming to the U.S. A refugee resettlement volunteer who worked with Lakhanwal shared emails with NPR written in 2024, indicating that Lakhanwal appeared to suffer a personal crisis after failing to find stable employment. The volunteer spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity because they feared for their safety after working to support Lakhanwal and other Afghan refugees. Daoud says this kind of emotional distress became widespread among former soldiers.
We had worse cases than Lakhanwal.
Daoud says he knows of at least four former Zero Unit fighters who became so desperate and hopeless they took their own lives. He described one crisis involving a friend who ultimately survived.
He was in a very stressful situation. He was like, I'm going to go kill myself. That's how bad it was. And I was very worried for him.
Bakshi, the former CIA agent, now runs an organization called FAMIL USA that advocates for Zero Unit soldiers. She says her group tried to warn the Biden administration as early as 2023 of this growing problem.
Individuals from the Zero Units unfortunately suffer death by self-harm. We raised this issue to the Biden administration, and it was one that we were very concerned about. Again, we saw a direct connection to prolonged immigration delays.
NPR sent detailed questions to the CIA and to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, but they declined to comment on the record. But Bakshi and Daoud aren't alone in raising concerns about the welfare of former Afghan Special Forces soldiers now living in the U.S. Thomas Kaza served with the Green Berets in Kabul alongside Afghan soldiers who specialized in clearing landmines and IEDs.
In the span that Americans would do one deployment, these guys are doing three, four, five, right? So you have to kind of be cognizant of the impact that's going to take.
Kaza says despite the Lakhanwal case, he doesn't think former Afghan soldiers pose a security risk in the U.S., but he thinks many Afghan soldiers are struggling with trauma compounded by their uncertain asylum status.
The Afghans were providing the exact same services, even more, right? But no one's really thinking of them for the service. And with that service also goes with kind of the side effects that are incumbent upon this profession, you know, all the PTSD, and that has never been something provided for the Afghan population.
Uncertainty for Afghan soldiers has only grown since the D.C. attack. President Trump says Afghans brought to the U.S. by the Biden administration may be dangerous. He's frozen asylum claims, and officials are reevaluating the legal status of Afghan refugees.
This heinous atrocity reminds us that we have no greater national security priority than ensuring that we have full control over the people that enter and remain in our country. For the most part, we don't want them.
In a statement, CIA Director John Ratcliffe also suggested America's zero unit allies may now be unwelcome. This individual and so many others should have never been allowed to come here, Ratcliffe said. Daoud, the Afghan who fought alongside CIA agents, said those comments sent waves of fear through his community.
I was very shocked with the head of the CIA's comment. I felt so betrayed.
Daoud says despite years of frustration, he and many of his fellow Afghan fighters now view the U.S. as their home and their only safe refuge.
We're part of this nation at this time. You don't want to send these folks back to Afghanistan. You're sentencing them to death.
Some U.S. veteran groups that fought with Afghan allies are now scrambling to convince the Trump administration to soften its stance on refugees who served with American military and intelligence services. But so far, Trump has maintained his fierce rhetoric. In a speech last night in Philadelphia, he objected again to taking in asylum seekers from what he described as hellholes like Afghanistan. Brian Mann, NPR News.
And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide or in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
18 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this state. Support comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Mostly cloudy overnight, lows near 3 below, and tomorrow mostly cloudy, highs 10 to 15, slight chance of snow in the afternoon.
On today's date, December 10th, 2006, I spot a rusty blackbird down along the banks of a backwater of the Mississippi River. The bird is not the black of the summer, but rather a sort of a mottled brown. And at first, I'm confused over its identity, but checking the field guide, I am assured that it is a rusty blackbird. It has a pale iris. It's a slender bird, not quite as thick and bulky as the red-winged blackbird. It eats insects, and this time of year, probably getting seeds from along the edge of the backwater there. It typically is found near spruce trees and bogs, sometimes marshes. It is this time of year most likely to be found in southern Minnesota, the southeastern corners of Minnesota, or somewhere to the south of that. In the summertime, this bird is not common. It's never common across its range, but it's not common in northern Minnesota, but more likely to be found north of the border. So watch for the rusty blackbird. You may be surprised.
NPR comes from the station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is a different kind of immigration agency from others in the government. It's where people go when they want to apply for asylum or get a green card or even become a citizen. But the Trump administration is now using this agency to clamp down on legal forms of migration. NPR's immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo is following this story. Hi, Jimena.
Hey, Scott.
Tell us a bit more about what this agency does compared to the other immigration agencies we've heard.
So USCIS is housed within the Homeland Security Department, and that means it's under the same department as Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection. But USCIS has not been responsible for making arrests, putting people in detention, or facilitating deportations. They're a lot more like a customer service agency. So people come to them and say, hey, I want to apply for asylum, or I want to apply for a green card. Mm-hmm. And USCIS processes those applications and decides if that person qualifies or not. Even their funding is completely different. ICE and Customs and Border Protection are funded by Congress. USCIS is actually funded by the fees people pay when they apply for these things.
So that's the baseline. That's how the agency has been working. Mm-hmm. How has the administration changed things?
Posts on social media mostly seem to reference immigration fraud and warn immigrants that they could be deported if they commit it. The director, Joseph Edlow, has emphasized that USCIS is going to be an enforcement agency. Here he is at his Senate confirmation hearing.
My vision for USCIS is simple. I will restore integrity within the legal immigration system. While the whole Department of Homeland Security is working hard to make America safe again, USCIS must play as critical a role in that mission as any other immigration enforcement agency.
That rhetoric mirrors the first Trump administration, except this time they are taking it a step further.
How so?
While there are reports that people are being detained at routine green card or citizenship interviews, immigrants are afraid of engaging with the agency. Here's Eric Welsh, an immigration lawyer in California.
I mean, number one is, am I going to get arrested? In almost every type of case, regardless of their past.
There has been a string of changes. The agency has rolled out lengthier citizenship tests. It wants to allow officers to consider immigrants' legal use of public benefits like food stamps and health care as a reason to deny legal status. The agency has also dropped the cap of refugee admissions to a historic low of 7,500. And the administration told officers that they will be re-vetting and re-interviewing those who were granted refugee status under the Biden administration. Then, after an Afghan national was charged in the shooting of two National Guards members, the agency put a pause on all asylum applications, and it paused all applications or approvals for green cards or citizenship, for example, from people of 19 countries on a travel ban list.
I mean, that is a lot of drastic steps. How are people within the agency dealing with all these changes?
Across the board, employees tell me that they are honestly offended that the administration is implying that they are now enforcing immigration laws and that they weren't before. Some are quitting or taking early retirement offers. They're also feeling out of the loop. The administration terminated the union's contract, and there's been no large meetings or town halls, and that's coming from current and former employees. Workers have been asked to go back to office, but their offices were sometimes makeshift conference rooms and tables. Plus, a lot of the programs that they used to work on have been fairly inactive for most of the year. USCIS told me that it's a priority to have safety for Americans, but it didn't respond to questions about broader concerns. And the agency is promoting some new roles, homeland defenders and special agents. Mm-hmm. It's unclear exactly what these positions are going to be responsible for, but some of the job postings specify that these positions are going to be expected to provide direct support to Border Patrol and ICE, which are arresting and deporting immigrants. So there are a lot of questions about these agencies' role moving forward.
That is NPR's immigration policy reporter, Jimena Bustillo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Better late than never. That was the message from the Nobel Peace Prize Committee today for this year's winner, who did not quite make it to Norway for today's ceremony. Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado had been hiding inside Venezuela to avoid being arrested by her country's authoritarian regime. On her way to Oslo, she got delayed as she reportedly escaped her country on a secret boat trip. As John Otis reports, her troubles in getting to Norway only dramatized her message that Venezuela is in dire need of regime change.
Maria Corina Machado was supposed to arrive in Oslo yesterday, where Latin American presidents, Venezuelan politicians, and her family had gathered for the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony, but she was nowhere to be found. Finally, she connected by phone this morning with Jorgen Watney Friedness, chair of the Nobel Institute.
Hello.
Hello.
Jorgen.
Hi.
Hi, Jorgen.
Is it Maria Corina?
Yes.
First, I just want to say we're so happy to hear your voice. We're so happy to hear that you're safe.
Me too.
It turns out that Machado had to make a daring water departure from Venezuela, but bad weather delayed her journey. According to U.S. officials cited by the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg, she took a clandestine boat trip to the Dutch Caribbean island of Curaçao before flying to Oslo. NPR could not independently confirm this. Machado said she was in, quote, extreme danger, and that many people risked their lives to help her escape.
As soon as I arrive, I will be able to embrace all my family and my children that I have not seen for 2 years.
As Machado was flying across the Atlantic, the prize ceremony began.
The laureate's daughter, Ana Corina.
Machado was awarded the prize for her work to bring about a peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy in Venezuela, especially during last year's presidential election. Although she was banned from running in that race, she helped convince millions of Venezuelans to vote for her substitute candidate, Edmundo González. According to voter tally sheets, González trounced President Nicolás Maduro. Maduro refused to give up power, and his military crushed anti-government protests. But, as Nobel Chair Friedness noted, Machado has continued to oppose his regime from hiding inside Venezuela.
Maria Corina Machado is one of the most extraordinary examples of civilian courage in recent Latin American history.
Friedness then turned to Machado's daughter, Ana, who was standing in for her at the ceremony. Reciting her mother's words, she said the Nobel Peace Prize belongs to all Venezuelans who have sacrificed for their country's freedom.
To them belongs this honor. To them belongs this day. To them belongs the future. Gracias.
The ceremony took place as U.S. warships gather in the Caribbean, and President Trump vows that Maduro's days are numbered. After trying all other means, Machado now supports U.S. military intervention to oust Maduro. That has made her a controversial recipient of the Peace Prize and has sparked scattered demonstrations. On Wednesday, Venezuela's Vice President, Delcy Rodriguez, said the Peace Prize was, quote, stained in blood, and that Machado skipped the ceremony because she feared protests against her. But in his speech, Friedness, the Nobel chair, called it a mistake to paint Machado and other Venezuelans trying to end a dictatorship as warmongers.
The narrative is turned upside down when the victims are branded as aggressors. This is a version of reality that the Maduro regime tells the world.
For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up, National Native News, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the Gigazone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic, Gigazone internet speeds up to 10 gig, and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. We also thank the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Taking a look at our weather, mostly cloudy tonight, lows near 3 below zero. And for tomorrow, slight chance of snow in the afternoon, mostly cloudy, highs 10 to 15. Lows tomorrow night, 1 to 4 below zero. And then Friday, chance of snow in the morning, mostly cloudy, highs in the lower teens.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For people experiencing addiction, it can help to talk to someone who's been through recovery themselves. Peer support specialists offer a different kind of support from therapists or psychiatrists. And in Alaska, there are state certificates for peer support roles, including a special track for Indigenous people with lived experience in recovery. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has more on peer-to-peer care in this state.
Josh Engel is bundled up on one of the first really cold days in October to do outreach in a homeless encampment in Anchorage. He approaches a man in a weathered coat.
How long have you been out here on the streets?
Too long.
Yeah? You connected with any resources?
Engel is a manager and peer support specialist at True North Recovery in Wasilla. One of his aims today is to help guide people into recovery. It's a path Engel knows well because he's in long-term recovery himself. Now, he supports people in ways that go well beyond what a more traditional therapist or psychiatrist can do. He may text with clients outside business hours, help them find work or get connected with benefits, anything that supports them in a way that might lead to recovery.
I personally really enjoy being able to connect with them on like a personal level of someone that has walked their path.
When patients interact with workers with lived experience, research shows it can aid recovery and can reduce healthcare costs. Erin Surma is executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, in Juneau. And Surma experiences mental illness himself. He says psychiatrists and mental health professionals play an important role in supporting recovery and treatment, but there is a strong power difference.
The dynamic is that you have the expert and the person who needs help.
Surma says he was arrested multiple times during high school and was court-ordered to go to Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous meetings. He says hearing peers in those groups was awesome, but things felt different when talking with his formal providers.
When I was a teenager, I was lighting stuff on fire and buying garbage bags of weed. So then to go into a small room and talk to somebody, it's a million miles from what you know.
He says it's easier for peers to bridge those gaps in early recovery. Peer support specialists speak the language of addiction and mental illness and also understand the more traditional language of behavioral health professionals. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Seeds of Eden, which offers addiction recovery services and community-based behavioral health services, recently received a $30,000 grant from the South Dakota Community Foundation. The grant will help the organization with its work to provide sober living, peer support, care coordination, and case management, including a project to build a recovery housing facility on the Standing Rock Reservation on the South Dakota side. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe straddles the South Dakota and North Dakota border. Isaiah Keller is one of the co-founders of Seeds of Eden. He says they've already secured a home, which is being remodeled to offer future services.
The house that we have been remodeling is about 90% complete. A small portion of the funds that were awarded will go to finish that house and to make it livable and to make it functional.
Keller says Seeds of Eden was designed to help fill a gap when it comes to addiction recovery services. And he says the group realized there was a need for assistance within tribal communities. He says they've been working closely with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Native American board members, and Native advocates.
We've partnered with a really good ally and advocate, and her name's Bobby Jamerson. She has been advocating and promoting recovery and community involvement. We're at a point right now where we feel like we have some great traction and some great movement.
Keller says they'd like to expand services across South Dakota and beyond. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver resources. The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IACB, who support this program.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Gen Z and millennials are expected to make up about half of all eligible voters next year. It's a group that typically voted in large numbers for Democrats, but Republicans were able to narrow that gap in 2024. Now, how they vote in 2026 could be key in determining control of Congress. Joining us now to talk about all of this is NPR political reporter Elena Moore. Hi, Elena.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so what do we know about what's going on with the youth vote right now?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of folks are unhappy with politics, and that's spelled out pretty clearly in a new Gen Forward survey from the University of Chicago, which was first obtained by NPR. It surveyed more than 5,000 Americans between the ages of 18 and 42 and found that nearly 60% disapprove of President Trump's job in office. And on the flip side, only 30% approve. And that's a six-point drop compared to his favorability rating last time, you know, this time last year.
Okay, well, that's about Trump, but we're less than a year away from the midterms at this point. What did they say about Democrats and Republicans in Congress?
Yeah, well, the results do paint a sobering picture for both parties. When folks were asked who they'd choose on a generic congressional ballot, you know, Democrats or Republicans, mm-hmm. Democrats lead by 15 points. But there are some caveats here. You know, young people's support for Democrats has dropped pretty dramatically since last year. And now roughly 6 in 10 have unfavorable impressions of both the Democrats and the Republicans. There's also just a loud call for more party options. You know, pollsters asked respondents if they agreed with the statement that both Democrats and Republicans do such a poor job representing the American people that voters need more political party choices. Mm-hmm. And Elsa, more than 80% said yes to that.
80%. Wow. What might be driving that?
I mean, I talked to Professor Kathy Cohen about this. She's the founder and director of the Gen Forward survey. And she argues that, you know, political dissatisfaction that young people are feeling is directly tied to their deeply rooted economic concerns.
There is a real sense that these individuals and these parts of the administration are not delivering. Young people are feeling like the state or the government is not, in fact, providing the opportunities that they're seeking.
And the poll finds that nearly 9 in 10 young people are concerned about the price of food and the cost of health care in this country. Plus, I mean, about a third think they're going to be worse off financially than their parents. So right now, I mean, quite a grim outlook.
Yeah. How did these economic concerns fit into their views of other big institutions, you think?
Yeah, I mean, that gets at Cohen's main takeaway from this poll. You know, when asked about factors needed to make democracy work well in the U.S., housing and affordability of food were the top choices after the need for free and fair elections. And to Cohen, you know, that shows that young people believe that their economic struggles are really intertwined with their feelings about democracy.
These young people are saying that without the ability to have full lives, they can't be full citizens. And they're rejecting this idea that we should separate discussions of democracy from discussions of affordability.
So, Elsa, essentially they're saying if the economy isn't working well, neither are the political institutions in charge of fixing it.
Huh. Okay. Well, Elena, you have pored over all of this data. What do you think is the big takeaway here?
Well, I think a lot of young people just
you know, feel unseen. And there are examples that said when young people are taken seriously, they can, you know, prove decisive in elections. I mean, look at Democrats' win in the New York mayoral race. Sohrab Mamdani centered his campaign on affordability. Or, you know, even Trump's bid in 2024. A lot of young people supported him because of his focus, at least at the time, on inflation. But as this poll shows, those concerns are still very much out there.
Indeed. That is NPR's Elena Moore. Thank you so much, Elena.
Thanks.
If you feel burned out or dispirited by the pressures of life, there is a word for that: involution. In Mandarin Chinese, involution is now an omnipresent slang term. For our Word of the Week series, NPR's Emily Fang tells us about its bilingual history.
Involution first appeared in English in an academic tract by American anthropologist Clifford Geertz on Dutch colonial society in Indonesia. He'd observed people working harder than ever on the land, but yielding less and less food. The term involution then bounced around, appearing in a study of tax collectors in early 20th century China.
Shuli, they were called Shuli.
This is Prasenjit Dwara, a professor at Duke University. He wrote the study, and he noticed these shuli tax collectors were actually not that good at forcing peasants to pay up.
So this then suggested to me that there was this involution, administrative involution.
His resulting book got translated into Chinese. But how to translate involution? Book translators came up with the phrase neijuan, combining the Mandarin words for inner, nay, and to curl or to roll, zhuan, invoking this idea of cycling endlessly back into oneself. Neijuan, as a Mandarin term, might have stayed in academic parlance if not for the global coronavirus pandemic in early 2020.
I still vividly remember I gave a long interview to a Chinese journalist.
This is Biao Xiang, director of the Max Planck Institute for Anthropology. In that interview in 2020, he set down the first definition for how neijuan is now used.
You feel you have to intensify your effort competing with other people for no purpose, yet you cannot quit.
And from there, neijuan took off among the Chinese public.
I somehow just put words to how people already know and already feel.
People use neijuan to describe something as useless or doing something just for appearances. You'd say, that's so juan. Then neijuan got memeified. Like this video of an elite Chinese university student studying on his laptop even while biking at night, becoming a visual emblem of neijuan. And now, neijuan has entered official bureaucratic lexicon. In 2024, China's top economic official Li Qiang criticized, quote, spiraling involution in the economy, describing a chronic problem where too many Chinese companies are competing with each other and producing the same thing.
有利提振消费.
Then, this year, Chinese policymakers led by the country's top leader Xi Jinping kicked off their anti-involution campaign to crack down on this overcapacity in production. So, the term has come full circle to its roots, describing unproductive economic activity. Might one say the word neijuan has made a full involution? Emily Fang, NPR News.
It has been a year since the Assad regime was overthrown in Syria. On tomorrow's show, we meet Syrian revolutionaries trying to restart their lives, only to run into new divisions and old animosities, and calling into question what true peace might look like. Be sure to come back here for that reporting. Just turn on your radio or ask your smart speaker to play your local station. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, North Star Stories produced by Amper's Stories from Throughout Minnesota. We receive support from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji, providing full-service interior painting in residential and commercial locations in northern Minnesota since 2009. More information at borealbrushworkspainting.com. And we thank North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region, 6 o'clock as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7, Dave Murphy, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows near 3 below, and slight chance of snow tomorrow afternoon, highs 10 to 15.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, Minnesota lawmakers condemn the end of protections for refugees. Then, why thousands of Minnesotans are at risk of food insecurity. And some patients in the Twin Cities are getting a little extra help when it comes to practicing their religions. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Senate Asian Pacific Caucus is condemning the Trump administration's move to end temporary protected status, or TPS, for nearly 4,000 Minnesota immigrants from Southeast Asia. Most of those immigrants are members of the Karen community from the eastern region of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. Minnesota is home to about 20,000 people from the Karen community, making it the largest in the country. This move follows the administration's announcement to end TPS protections for Somali Minnesotans. Next, nearly 500,000 Minnesotans are receiving food benefits, but even with the federal programs back in operation, thousands of Minnesotans could lose their benefits entirely. Producer Nock Bowie explains why.
The shutdown was just the latest curveball for Minnesotans on SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, a federal program that helps people pay for groceries.
I think it's a very difficult time for SNAP recipients right now, just to understand and keep up with the ever-changing nature of what has been happening.
Tiki Brown is the commissioner of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, or DCYF, which oversees the implementation of the SNAP program in our state. Even though payments are back on schedule, Commissioner Brown says there are significant changes to SNAP ahead and already in place as a result of the One Big Beautiful Bill, also known as H.R. 1. The bill passed in July is set to cut $120 billion from SNAP nationwide over the next 10 years. DCYF estimates Minnesota will lose about half of the federal reimbursements it's been getting.
We know that the state cannot make up for all of the federal funding that has been coming into our state. I don't think any state can across the nation.
Commissioner Brown says she's trying to figure out how to address this impending nearly $40 million shortfall.
Do we need to modify or adjust ways that we have traditionally done the program in order to manage some of these cost shifts that are coming? I think the counties have been really clear about how they are having to raise their property taxes to help manage some of the anticipated administrative cuts.
On the ground, hunger relief organizations like Second Harvest Heartland are trying to help the thousands of Minnesotans who could lose access to SNAP benefits due to expanded minimum work requirements that went into effect in November. That change has led to more people needing to prove they are working a certain number of hours in order to receive benefits.
I think we had a call recently from somebody who was 64, and they got a letter in the mail saying they're going to have to go back to work.
That's Mesa Siebert with Second Harvest.
And they were really scared. They were wondering how that was going to happen. They live in a rural area. There's not a lot of jobs. They're on disability.
Siebert says there are also changes to eligibility that have occurred due to H.R. 1.
Folks who are here legally, maybe on a refugee visa or an asylee visa, a trafficking humanitarian visa, will be impacted by the H.R. 1 bill.
Commissioner Brown anticipates all these cuts and changes will stress an already stressed system.
There are long-term impacts that impact everybody across the state as a result of these federal cost shifts. And we already see over 9 million visits per year with our food shelves, and that need is increasing. And so we have a real issue, I think, with ensuring that people get the food they need with more and more limited resources and more constraints, and that's a pretty significant concern.
This is Nak Bui for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Hennepin County Medical Center is expanding religious accommodations in its inpatient psychiatry department. Hennepin Healthcare, located in Minneapolis, has added more than 70 Qibla stickers, markers that show the direction Muslims face when performing their daily prayers, which is toward the Kaaba in Mecca. The effort began after a doctor in the emergency department noticed a patient praying in the wrong direction and researched how hotels use similar markers.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This division is enjoying a comeback. This is a widescreen movie format from the 1950s, but two films now getting awards buzz, One Battle After Another and Begonia, were shot with restored VistaVision cameras. As NPR's Madalit DeBarco reports, some of today's top filmmakers hope the old tech gets new audiences into theaters.
In 1954, Paramount Pictures introduced cinemagoers to its first VistaVision movie, White Christmas, with this promo.
VistaVision, the ultimate in film presentation that will thrill all your senses with its unbelievable clarity, sharpness, brilliance.
Charlotte Barker is director of film restoration and preservation at Paramount Pictures. Her office is filled with VistaVision memorabilia and a vintage VistaVision camera. She's also writing a book about VistaVision, which she says was part of the widescreen craze of the 1950s that started with Cinerama.
This is Cinerama.
Then 20th Century Fox came out with CinemaScope,
which would squeeze an image onto regular 35mm film. But by doing that, that added a lot of film grain. And so that's what Paramount didn't like about that.
Barker says VistaVision was Paramount's response. It used 35mm film, but instead of running through the camera vertically, it feeds through horizontally, like a still camera. As a result, the image is twice the size.
There's no grain. And the image clarity is beautiful. It showed the full view of your eye, like what your vision sees in your peripherals. That was the scope of VistaVision.
Paramount actually held a patent for the widescreen format in the 1920s, but it was later developed as VistaVision by the studio's sound director and chief engineer and the head of the studio's camera departments. Their technical achievements earned them Academy Awards.
Behold his mighty hand!
Filmmaker Cecil B. DeMille used VistaVision for the 1956 remake of his epic, The Ten Commandments. And Alfred Hitchcock used VistaVision cameras to shoot many of his iconic films, including North by Northwest, To Catch a Thief, and Vertigo. Barker says Paramount and its directors hoped the format would lure people to the movie theaters at a time when television was becoming popular.
This was absolutely a ploy to try to get people back in, to show them something that they couldn't get from their own couch at home.
But she says VistaVision soon fell out of fashion. Once Panavision created better wide-angle lenses, Paramount released its last VistaVision film, One-Eyed Jacks, in 1961.
After that, they just couldn't justify spending the extra money, especially for the amount of film that had to be used in the camera.
VistaVision found a new hope in the 1970s when George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic used it to shoot the special effects of Star Wars.
George wanted a realistic representation of space travel.
John Dykstra led the team in winning the 1978 Oscar for Best Visual Effects. He says they developed their own cameras with the horizontal format.
We built more than one. I can't remember how many, but we did modifications on existing VistaVision cameras. They were basic legacy devices. They were big, clunky things.
Dykstra says the cameras allowed them to animate the motion of miniature ships flying through space.
George, bless him, was trying something different.
Also on the crew was Dennis Muren, who became a visual effects supervisor at Lucasfilm for 40 years.
You know, we build equipment to do all the maneuvering of the spaceships. In this better format, this bigger film aspect ratio, more consistent with the live action photography, so they look like you're out in space flying around.
Now, in this age of streaming, live-action filmmakers have revived VistaVision, once again hoping audiences watch in cinemas.
The people here, they do not want us here.
Most of the period drama The Brutalist was shot in VistaVision by Lal Crawley, earning him the 2025 Oscar for Cinematography.
The VistaVision camera enabled us to shoot these incredible high-resolution images and avoid this sort of distortion of a wider-angle lens.
The architecture, marble quarries, and landscapes Crawley shot in Hungary were gorgeous, but he says the vintage Beaumont VistaVision camera he used was as finicky as a classic car.
They're just beautiful pieces of machine. You know, and you have to forgive them their failings.
That's because VistaVision cameras are divas, larger than life and very noisy.
I can't think of anything more off-putting than trying to give this very nuanced, sensitive, quiet performance with this with this camera rattling away at you, you know. But, you know, so sometimes we just had to put up with it.
Okay, ready, and here we go.
From his home in Los Angeles, actor Giovanni Ribisi demonstrates his refurbished VistaVision camera, the same one he lent to Paul Thomas Anderson to shoot one battle after another. The film's director of photography, Michael Bauman, says they ended up with three cameras, which were very loud.
It's kind of like starting up a lawnmower. All of a sudden, the camera just goes, and just stop. All right, we got jam. Let's figure it out. Sometimes film would come flying out.
Bauman says throughout the shoot, he was constantly tweaking the bespoke cameras.
You know, you're trying to resurrect a great format back from the dead. And it can be frustrating at times, but the visual value of what we were getting was well worth the pain and misery at the time.
You can see the payoff in the dramatic climax of one battle after another. Bauman and his crew strapped a VistaVision camera to the front bumpers of a car for a chase through a rolling desert landscape.
So we could get the camera just a few inches off the surface of the road, which provides that super dynamic image with the wide lens of going over the hills, what we call the River of Hills. It gets an incredibly powerful sequence.
Like Hitchcock, today's filmmakers cover the cameras with soundproofing cases to muzzle the noise, especially useful for scenes with lots of close-up conversation.
Can we have a dialogue, please?
Don't call it a dialogue. This isn't Death of a Salesman.
Okay, can we talk?
For his film Begonia, Yorgos Lanthimos says he wanted the wide-angle look, even though much of the film is set in a cramped basement.
I felt the juxtaposition of filming close-ups of faces in a very limited space with that kind of format made them iconic. It's almost like photography portraiture.
Lanthimos first experimented with VistaVision in 2021 for a scene in his film Poor Things. And for Begonia, he again worked with cinematographer Robbie Ryan.
I got a little bit traumatized when the whole shoot was going on a daily basis, but I loved it because it was a really, it's a massive camera. And because the magazines are horizontal, you can almost put your cup of tea on it, you know, so it was great.
Ryan says they were able to work out some of the kinks.
It's called VistaVision, so you think you're going to get all this landscape photography, but the landscape in Begonia is the face. You know, just looking at the iconic bald Emma Stone with antihistamine cream all over helped make that even more super real. It zings off the screen. The results are so gorgeous.
Coming soon to a theater near you are other films shot in VistaVision, including Wuthering Heights, Greta Gerwig's Narnia, and the new Tom Cruise movie by Alejandro González Iñárritu. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters this Friday. From Total Wine and More, where people can find wines, spirits, and beers for holiday gatherings at Total Wine and More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, With a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock tonight, Dave Murphy, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Our weather for tonight, mostly cloudy, lows near 3 below, and tomorrow mostly cloudy, highs 10 to 15, slight chance for snow in the afternoon. For Friday, slight chance of snow in the morning with mostly cloudy skies.